This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you like a bagel with a schmear, but don't care bupkis for wearing a tight shmata that could press on your kishkis and make you look like a schlemiel, well, then you already know some Yiddish. And you're about to learn some more from Michael Wex, the author of Born to Kvetch. Wex is a teacher and translator who also does a one-man show called Sex in Yiddish. He's translated Irving Berlin songs and the Three Penny Opera into Yiddish. He lives in Toronto. Kvetch means complain. But for a more complete definition, listen to this joke that Wex tells in his book, Born to Kvetch.
You know, it's a very old joke, but it is the classic definition. A man gets onto a train. He's going, say, from, you know, New York to Philadelphia. Opposite him is sitting an older Jewish man who gets into his chair, sits back down, and as soon as the train is pulled out of the station, leans back into his chair, looks up at the ceiling and says, "Oy, am I toasty." 10 seconds pass and he says it again, "Oy, am I toasty." By the time he gets to the third, "Oy, am I toasty," the person sitting opposite him knows that there's no hope. He's stuck with this unless he gets up and actually does something about it. So he makes his way down to the end of the train where they have the little thing of water with the conical paper cups. And he pulls down a conical paper cup and he fills it up with water, turns around, starts to walk back down the corridor of the moving train, stops and thinks for a second, goes back, gets a second conical paper cup of water. So now he's walking down the middle of the moving train, balancing two of these cone-shaped cups, trying desperately not to spill anything on himself or on the innocent passengers that are sitting along the way. This man with the cups, he hands one to the old man, who looks up at him with eyes full of gratitude, swallows it, has a big grin of gratitude on his face. But before he can say or do anything, the other man hands him the other cup and says, "Here, drink this one too." 30 seconds later, the old man pushes himself back in the chair, looks up at the ceiling again and says, "Oy, was I toasty." And this, of course, is the essence of kvetch. The Yiddish kvetch has overcome the satisfaction barrier. Among other peoples, I think, if somebody has a complaint, they want a glass of water, you give it to them, they drink it, and they're happy. Only the Yiddish-speaking Jewish people have learned how to complain their way through satisfaction as well.
What is the origin of the word kvetch? What does it literally mean?
Well, literally, if you were to look in a Yiddish-English dictionary, if you looked up kvetchen, the verb form, it would say to press, to squeeze, to urge. So if you make orange juice in Yiddish, you kvetch the orange in order to get the juice out of it. If you shrug your shoulders, you kvetch mit de pleitzes, you kvetch, you squeeze with your shoulders. But in the meaning of complaint, it comes from one further meaning of kvetch that you don't always see in the dictionaries. This is the reflexive. If you kvetch yourself, it means you're squeezing or pressing in upon yourself because you've neglected, shall we say, to eat your prunes this morning. And you're trying to do something that should normally come a lot more easily. The connection here is between the tone of voice. The person who's kvetching has exactly the tone of voice of someone who is striving to eliminate what shouldn't be there.
Now, a word that you used a lot in the joke that you told was oi. Oi, am I toasty. Why is oi such a commonly used Yiddish word? And what is it, you know, how is it used in Yiddish? What does it mean?
Oi basically means oi. It's like one of those Louis Armstrong words. If you've got to ask, you're fortunate enough that you'll never know. Oi is basically an exclamation of shock, dismay, discomfort, disapproval, displeasure, or any of the other normal Yiddish emotions, all of which have the English prefix dis attached to them. It's one of the oldest words in the language and comes from the Bible. It's an ancient Hebrew word, it's still used, of course, in modern Hebrew as well, and is this kind of expression of just overwhelming physical or emotional pain. it's, of course, been weakened, I guess, a bit through overuse to being the beginning of almost any sentence in a normal Yiddish conversation. But the basic meaning is like, oh, hell, oh, my God, something like that.
And in its full use, it could be oy veyizmir.
Yeah, well, oy veyizmir, this is, veyizmir is literally woe is me. So what you get here, you get Yiddish in a nutshell, where you have a Hebraic version of a particular phenomenon or emotion followed immediately by a Germanic version of exactly the same thing. So veyizmir is almost, as it were, the translation of oy, which is interesting because the whole Jewish school system for a good millennium ran on the basis of translating Hebrew texts out loud into Yiddish. So any kid confronted with the word oy in the Bible and asked by the teacher to stand up and say what oy means would stand up and go, oy veyizmir. And this just became codified as a way of expressing, horrible disbelief or discomfort or whatever.
Do you think it's any coincidence that there's so much kvetching and oying in Yiddish?
Oh, no coincidence at all. Again, Yiddish has simply taken something that was present in Jewish life long before the language developed and kind of run with it. If you look in the Bible, from the time of the Exodus from Egypt in the book of Exodus, the entire plot of the Bible is the children of Israel kvetch. God does them a favor. They kvetch. Sometimes they misbehave and get punished, then they kvetch. Then God does them a favor and they kvetch some more. If you look in a standard English translation of the Bible, you'll see it always says, and the children of Israel murmured. Murmur is the fancy 17th century word for kvetch. So there's a famous passage in the book of Exodus where it's just as the Red Sea is about to split. So these people have already witnessed 10 horrible plagues that have really caused the Egyptians a great deal of suffering and loss of life. Moses has told them everything's cool. God's with us. He's taking us out. They're standing at the lip of the Red Sea. Moses is up in front. Pharaoh, as portrayed by Yul Brynner, is coming up behind. The children of Israel look up at Charlton Heston, and they don't pray. They don't say thank you. They say, what, there weren't enough graves in Egypt that you had to bring us out into the desert to die? This is at the greatest biblical miracle ever. You know, the whole religion defines itself at this one moment. And what's going on at this one moment? Every adherent of that religion, with the exception of Moses himself, is kvetching. And they haven't stopped since.
How much do you think that the amount of kvetching that happens in Yiddish is connected to, you know, all the real troubles that Jewish people have experienced through the history of Judaism? The persecution, the exile, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I think they're pretty closely connected.
Yeah,
uh-huh. Yeah, partly this was just a way of powerless people. People who really had very little control over their own destiny and not a lot of say quite often over the conditions of their own lives. You know, they were only allowed to live in certain areas. In some places, they had to be shut back up at night. This was a way of blowing off steam in situations where there was nothing else. You know, they had nowhere else they could go to. You know, the big thing about exile, which is kind of the defining idea of the Jewish religion since the destruction of the Second Temple, is, of course, there is nowhere else to go. If things are bad here, there's no there for you to go back to. And I think people in that situation developed this kind of verbal home where the language and the complaining and everything else served almost as a stand-in or a substitute for a place that they could go to. You know, rather than go to a physical place, they could only go to this mental, verbal place. And that's sort of where they went for whatever R&R they could manage to get.
Okay, another Yiddish word, kinahura. What does that mean and how is it used?
It means literally no evil eye. And the Jewish belief in evil eyes and evil spirits and bad luck is very, very strong. So the idea of your saying anything nice without somehow qualifying it is very frightening. Like if I were to say, what a beautiful child you have in Yiddish and not qualify it with something like Kenahara, no evil eye, this would be virtually a curse on the kid. It would be like wishing that it should get ugly or something horrible should happen to it. Because these demons are always there lurking, waiting for a kind of opening where they can come in and mess things up. When you step on a glass at the end of a Jewish wedding, which is a custom I think most people are familiar with, even if only from television or movies, they'll tell you now that the reason for this is to mourn the destruction of Jerusalem. But if you look back in the really old commentaries, there's a passage in the Talmud that describes a rabbi going to a wedding and seeing that the other rabbis were having too good a time. And that's actually what it says. It says they were enjoying themselves more than they should have been. So he took an expensive glass goblet and smashed it in order to dampen their good spirits. The commentaries say this is the origin of the custom of breaking the glass at the wedding. That is, you give the evil spirits, the evil eye, whatever you want to call it, you give them their due by making sure that something has already gone wrong. So they can then say, aha, our work here is over, and we can go on to the wedding next door and wreck that and leave you in peace.
So you say in your book that, you know, part of the reason for the Kinahura is that there's this fear that liking something is the first step to losing it, and that if they know that you love something, they will try to take it. Is they just the demons, the Dybbuks, or is they also the non-Jewish people who you are afraid of because they have the power to oppress you and put you in ghettos and things like that?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely that they, too. And it's also even other jealous Jewish people. Mm-hmm. It's virtually anybody outside of that tiny nuclear family of yours.
And maybe the nuclear family, too. Probably,
yeah, well,
right?
Maybe. Well, especially them. But,
you can't really talk about Yiddish without getting into some of its more colorful curses. One of the curses in Yiddish, and I'll give the English version that you describe in your book, is you should swell up and suffer from varicose veins.
That's an geschwollen and gedrollen sollst du werden. And you can even go farther and say geschwollen und gedrollen sollst du werden wie ein Berg. You should swell up with varicosity, like a mountain. Again, the word for varicose veins here is almost never used in Yiddish outside of this curse and medical treatment. And it's interesting, a lot of the Yiddish curses can basically be looked at as subdivisions of medicine. You know, I think it's no accident that you, and I think a lot of people went to med school just to find out what their mothers had been yelling at them all these years.
You describe Yiddish as the original jive, a way to talk without others understanding what you're saying. Would you elaborate on that?
Yeah, much of Yiddish arose, of course, you know, I think most people know that most of the Yiddish vocabulary comes from some form or other of German. And yet Yiddish and German are two languages that have almost nothing in common, despite the fact that they share about 80% of their vocabulary. And I think to a large degree, Yiddish arose as a kind of German in which you could be living in the Middle Ages, a time when religion was the defining force of Western European life. You could live then and be able to deny the divinity of Jesus without getting yourself killed any more often than might have been strictly necessary given the circumstances. So there are all these Yiddish phrases, all these Yiddish terms that are, many of them are very, very common and still in day-to-day use that many people don't realize reflect negatively on the culture around them. So if I can give an example, there's a way of describing something as utter nonsense or total BS in Yiddish. You say it's nicht gestiegen und nicht geflogen, which means it didn't climb up and it didn't fly. If you ask virtually any older Jewish person from Europe, what didn't climb up and where it didn't fly, they'll tell you it was Jesus who did not ascend to the cross and did not subsequently fly off into heaven. This is a very, very common and slightly vulgar day-to-day term for, you know, yelling at somebody. An intelligent German speaker could get all the words easily because they all exist in one form or another in German, and probably from context be able to work out that this means, you know, don't feed me any of that garbage, don't tell me any stupid stories. But it's very unlikely that they would be able to see the connection between this phrase and the denial of the Christian religion. And Yiddish is just full of this kind of stuff from top to bottom.
What's another example?
Another example, there's a similar phrase that also means something, you know, an argument that doesn't hold water. To be as substantial or have a substantiality like that of the God of the Gentiles, where basically what's going on here, the word that's used, substance or substantiality, is a clear dig at the notion, the doctrine, I guess, of transubstantiation, which is, of course, pretty much the defining doctrine of Catholic Christianity. And for most of the history of Yiddish, it was Catholic Christians, whether they were Orthodox or Roman Catholics, amongst whom Yiddish speakers were living. So there was a great deal of this.
You say that Yiddish really flourished from the time of the Crusades to the time of the Holocaust. Why do those two catastrophes virtually define the beginning and end of the language?
I think in this case it's basically on the one side an unhappy accident that Yiddish was... Yiddish and German-Jewish culture were just really beginning to come into their own at the time of the First Crusade at the end of the 11th century. And all of a sudden, the rug was just pulled out from under all their cultural assumptions. They knew they were in exile, but they'd always been in exile. They knew that they might have to move one day, but they hadn't been there that long anyway. This was the first mass murder of Jewish people for no other reason than that they happened to be Jewish. And it had a profound effect, not just on Yiddish, but on general European Jewish culture, particularly the religious culture. And a lot of the negativity that I was just talking about originates from feelings of hostility engendered by this kind of treatment. Of course, at the other end of things, with the Holocaust that took place in the 20th century, you have simply the utter elimination of most of the people who spoke the language. And this, you know, subsequently, they came to North America. They went to Israel. Some of them did remain in Europe, but all of them were in circumstances now where the relationship of the Jewish people and the larger culture around it was very, very different than it had been even in 1939. And Yiddish simply began to lose momentum for any one of a number of reasons. You know, part of which is, of course, the establishment of the State of Israel and the sort of new assumption that modern Hebrew would become the international Jewish lingua franca.
And that hasn't really worked, has it? I mean, outside of Israel.
No, it hasn't. You certainly don't find too many groups of Jewish people who aren't Israelis getting together and speaking to each other in Hebrew as a matter of course. You can still find people who do that with Yiddish, though. And there's growing numbers, I guess.
You credit Lenny Bruce with bringing a lot of Yiddish words into the American English mainstream. What are some examples of words that you think Lenny Bruce helped popularize?
These are all, they all tend to mean the same thing. Schmuck, putz, schlong, schwanz. These are all vulgarisms for the male member. I think he used verstehst and things like that a bit too. But primarily, oh, and tuchus. He was very big. Can't forget tuchus, the buttocks. He was very big on stuff like that. For the simple reason that, of course, the people in Iowa from Standards and Practices in 1956 had absolutely no idea what these words meant and didn't realize how vulgar they actually are in a Yiddish rather than an English context. You know, I think today a lot of people don't even realize that words like schmuck and putz refer to a specific part of the anatomy and are not words you would ever use, say, in front of your parents if you were speaking Yiddish. They're really, you know, they're vulgar. They're dirty in Yiddish. Lenny put a lot of that stuff into circulation. I think the Three Stooges helped as well. Words like mishigas, which frequently fly around in Stooges things, also tended to penetrate from there. Early Mad Magazine had a lot of Yiddish. You know, everything in old Mad magazines was verschlugen. I want that verschlugener door closed, or whatever. So there was a great deal there, too.
And what does verschlugener mean?
Loosely damned. You know, close the damn door, close the verschlugener door. It's literal meaning is different, but that's the way it would be used idiomatically in Yiddish, too.
But that is considered a relatively clean term. I mean, that's like,
oh yeah,
parents
yeah,
would use that term all the time talking to their kids.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, verschlugen, as it has a number of meanings. There's an old Louis Prima song where he actually says, "I'm verschlugen, nutty in the noggin." You know, I've gone wild over you, basically.
Do you think like words like schmuck and putz have the same meaning in English now as they do in traditional Yiddish?
Yeah, because besides their anatomical meanings, they are used by extension to mean somebody that you would call, I guess, a jerk in normal English. The big difference in Yiddish is anybody can be a schmuck. You could say, oh, there I was, poor schmuck, standing out in the rain without my wallet. You could never describe yourself as a putz, though. A putz is always somebody else. A putz is vicious. A schmuck is just sort of a goof. So, you know, a driver who cuts you off because he really doesn't see you is a schmuck. A driver who cuts you off out of viciousness is a putz.
I didn't know that. I thought a putz was more like a nebbish.
No, that's more of the schmuck. we could debate this endlessly, couldn't we? Putz in Yiddish, a putz is sort of the schmuck rampant.
So, what do you think it means in terms of the history of Yiddish, though, that although the language that a whole culture speaks in a regular way has virtually died out, that words stay very much alive?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I think, you know, all of these words, you look at them, they convey something that the basic English translation just doesn't have in it. You know, there's an emotional coloring, if you want to call it that, that you just don't get from talking about, you know, somebody being a glutton, for instance, in English. It's not the same as calling them a chaser or a fresser.
And if somebody's wearing something that isn't very cool to call it a schmata.
Yeah, well, again, a schmata or schlock. There's a good
schlock,
one.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Which originally refers to what you used to use to make the linings of, you know, say a jacket with.
Oh.
So it was the material that wasn't good enough to be seen.
Second
or third rate goods become schlock, which again I think everybody uses.
And schmata, where does schmata come from?
Schmata originally is a Slavic word. It means a rag.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you're in the schmata business, the rag trade, as it were. And again, you can call a newspaper that you don't like is a schmata also, the same way you would call it a rag in English. A lot of these things have come in because people in Yiddish tend to scream at each other a lot. Yiddish words tend to have this very high emotional baggage that they bring with them. And again, because so much of Yiddish life was devoted to dealing with frustration in a way that I guess anticipated a lot of, you know, modern North American life, there's this open space for it to enter in and fill up those gaps that, you know, English, which was once a very polite language, just doesn't seem to have the words to fill.
Michael Wex, how did you learn Yiddish?
I actually have the rare distinction of having grown up speaking it with my parents, who were from Europe, although I should stress they actually came before World War II. I grew up in a fairly small town in southern Alberta in western Canada called Lethbridge, and later moved from there to Calgary, which is a somewhat bigger town in the same province, and eventually ended up in Toronto. But there was a Jewish community in Lethbridge, and because of the immigration patterns in Canada, even the post-war or the pre-war immigrants tended to be first-generation people who had come from Europe generally as small children or teenagers, but who were all equally comfortable in Yiddish and English.
You know, we've talked about, you know, like curses and complaints in the Yiddish language and how Yiddish is so caught up in curses and complaints. Let's end with some nice terms of endearment from Yiddish. What are some of your favorites? And what did your parents call you? What terms of endearment did they use for you when you were a child? Or none?
I think we're back to the curses. Yeah, we're back to the curses there. Which a lot of that was to avoid these evil eyes. It was easier to call you an idiot when you knew that idiot meant the opposite, because then you didn't have to start spitting and kananahoraing all over the place.
But as a kid, did you understand that if they called you an idiot?
If I were in therapy, I'd say ask my therapist. I really don't know. That's how you spoke. No, I mean, there are lots of endearments, really, and Ketzela, Ketzenu, all these things that literally mean little pussycat are very big. Again, the Gershwin song, I've Got a Crush on You, Sweetie Pie, in Yiddish comes out as Ich werde kapore far dir, Ketzenu. I'm a chicken that you wave around your head three times, my little pussycat. And I think that's Yiddish because it's perfectly idiomatic.
What a lovely thing to say.
Isn't it, though? It's, again, only in Yiddish could you reduce the plot of Wuthering Heights to something to do with poultry.
And why a chicken that you wave around three times? What's the significance of that?
It's a ritual that some people still do just before Yom Kippur. It's called Kaporis, or Atonements, in which you take a rooster or a hen, depending on whether you're a man or a woman, you wave it around your head three times, and you say, this is my substitute, this is my stand-in, this is my atonement. Let the chicken die, and I should live. And then you take the chicken off to be slaughtered. And because it's such an odd ritual, it's spawned all kinds of Yiddish idioms, one of which means to get a crush on somebody. The idea is you're so besotted with them that you'd let them pick you up by the legs, wave you around the head three times, have you killed, and then distributed to the poor.
Michael Wex, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Michael Wex is the author of Born to Kvetch.